ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Australia's world-first social media ban for kids under 16 is now in effect. Also, more homes destroyed in the bushfires on Tassie's east coast. And will Victoria's Phillip Island lose its famous motorcycle Grand Prix?
The last couple of years, it's been worth about $54 million. And it's, you know, almost 300 jobs. And they get over 70,000 people. I think even last year was up to 90,000.
Well, it's been a memorable day for many children and their parents, with Australia's world-first social media ban for under-16s coming into force. By law, they're now banned from using some of the world's most popular social media apps, like Instagram and TikTok. The federal government argues it'll give them a break from platforms that are designed to keep them scrolling on their phones and can expose them to harmful content. Some youngsters are happy about the ban, some are angry, while others are working hard to find ways to get around the new rules. Miwa Bloomer reports.
The ban officially takes place today, but when the ABC spoke to 13-year-old Addison in Perth last night, she'd already been locked out.
I actually got kicked off my Snapchat account about half an hour ago, and it's actually kind of a relief because it was getting quite annoying towards the end with streaks and just constantly having to keep up to date with what everyone else was doing.
Even though Addison, who's a youth advisor with Headspace, did use social media every day, she still thinks the ban on children under 16 from social media is a good thing.
I'm quite positive about it. The government obviously knows what they're talking about, so just go along with it.
She's moving to platforms like WhatsApp to chat with her friends, although it'll take a while to get set up.
I don't have a lot of people's numbers, but like tomorrow, I just know everyone's going to be like exchanging numbers.
While Addison is relieved the ban is now in place, not all of her friends agree.
So half my friend group is like, cannot wait. And my other half is like, oh my God, my life's going to end without social media. Like, not literally, but figuratively. They're quite upset about it. But because I haven't had it for a long time, only like 18 months, like some people have been on it since they were five. So obviously the circumstances have changed because I remember living without it.
This ban has been a long time in the making, and various groups have been preparing. Headspace is one of the country's biggest youth mental health organisations. For the past year, the team at Headspace has been focusing on helping families get ready. It's created online resources for children and parents to adapt to this shift. Psychologist Nicola Palfrey is the head of clinical practice at Headspace and says the organisation is also boosting online support for children.
And we're adding additional online chat spaces over the summer period, which we normally would be closed because we want to offer a space for young people to come and connect.
She says individuals' reactions to the ban will differ.
I think we will have the range of emotions. So some young people we know aren't that phased, but we think for a proportion of young people we will expect some distress. So some people that are feeling disconnected, that are feeling not quite sure what to do with themselves because they've found a lot of joy and connection online.
Nicola Palfrey believes there are positives that will come from the ban, but she's concerned it'll have some unintended consequences. One of those is that teens who find a way to use social media, regardless of the ban, and run into problems there, might avoid reaching out for help.
The last thing we want is that young people, if they are online, whether it be on social media platforms or any other part of the internet, and that they are exposed to content that they find distressing or that they are experiencing harms online through bullying or other more malicious forms of harm, we really don't want additional barriers for them letting their family and loved ones know so they can get the support. So that's why it's so important that we continue the conversation about online safety and how young people can protect themselves and what can be done if they're experiencing harms online.
She advises parents to continue to have conversations with their kids to help ensure their safety. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says the new law sends a message to tech companies that enough is enough.
Make no mistake, this reform will change lives for Australian kids and allowing them to just have their childhood, for Australian parents, enabling them to have greater peace of mind, but also for the global community who are looking at Australia and saying, well, if Australia can do it, why can't we?
Standing alongside the Prime Minister was one of the architects of the new law, eSafety Commissioner Julie Inman Grant.
Parents will be backed. Families can reconnect. Technology's tethers will loosen. Australia stands as a global change maker, firmly on the right side of history. And finally, in honour of the Prime Minister, to riff off my favourite rock band, The Who, the kids will be all right.
That's the eSafety Commissioner Julie Inman Grant, Miwa Bloomer, with that report. While the Communications Minister, Annika Wells, has been outselling the government's social media ban today, she's also been trying to move on from the public outcry over her parliamentary travel and entitlement expenses. It's been revealed the taxpayer has footed the bill for her family to fly interstate to join her at several events she's attended in her role as Sport Minister, and that she's racked up hefty bills for official cars. Both she and the Prime Minister are adamant she has complied with the rules at all times, but Ms. Wells has asked the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Authority to review her expenditure. As Rachel Mealy reports, the controversy is generating a discussion about how busy politicians should manage perks for their families during the cost of living crisis.
Annika Wells says she understands the strong community response to the news of her travel expenditures.
Look, I appreciate there's been a huge amount of public scrutiny of this, and I've been happy to answer questions as long as you want to go. But I absolutely understand, appreciate and agree that parliamentarians' entitlements should be scrutinised. I agree with that.
She says she's operated within the rules at all times.
I am incredibly serious about my work. I work really hard, and I try really hard every single day to discharge my duties. And I guess I'd put to you, Loretta, I'm the Australian Sport Minister. I go to Australian sporting events. I work at them. The stakeholders that are there expect to see me at them, expect to be able to talk to me there about different matters of sport policy. You would expect the Sport Minister to meet athletes where they are at.
The Parliament's expenditure rules allow MPs to charge taxpayers for business class flights so their families can join them while they work away from home. Annika Wells's husband has joined her at Boxing Day cricket tests and AFL Grand Finals. And in June this year, her husband and her three children joined her in Thredbo for the weekend, where she was attending a Paralympic skiing event.
No one expects any forgiveness for the political class. I understand that. And yes, I always think about how this is going to look to people when we make decisions about when we use the family travel entitlement.
Across the parliament, family reunion travel for all federal MPs and senators cost taxpayers more than $1.1 million in the last financial year. The Prime Minister says the average MP has changed over the last few decades and parliament is more representative than it used to be.
I think that Annika gave birth to twins while in office. That's something that wasn't happening, you know, decades ago. As a result of that, the Sure. Independent Authority has put in place measures to allow some family
Reuniting with a partner over a grand final weekend is different to reuniting with your kids, isn't it?
Well, partners are important as well. And so these things are set independently, and Annika Wells has referred herself to the authority. They'll have a look at it as is appropriate.
Opposition Senator Jane Hume says she supports a review of the rules, but the entitlements are right in principle.
We do want families to find Parliament a friendly place to work. We want to encourage people that have children or have caring responsibilities or have elderly parents to still think that politics is potentially a job for them. So that should be principle number one. But there should also be an understanding that when you make a decision to charge the taxpayer for airfares to go interstate for something that might happen to coincide, for instance, with a friend's birthday party, as Annika Wells did. Does that really meet the test?
Andrea Carson is a professor of political communication at La Trobe University.
clearly there are members of the public that feel this is out of step with what they would expect is reasonable for travel entitlements. I don't think this is an issue so much about Annika Wells, who, as it would appear at this point in time, has not breached the independent guidelines. It's more a question of whether these are reasonable and fair guidelines that need to be accountable and transparent. The fact that we're having the conversation suggests that there is accountability and transparency going on. It's more the unknowns of those we don't know about that would be of greater concern. But there is a bigger question here about whether the guidelines need to be reviewed in light of a cost of living crisis and whether this is reasonable for the electorate.
She says the way the story has unfolded this week has missed the important recognition that families of politicians are split apart because of the nature of the work.
So having measures in place that make it possible for women to come into the parliament is necessary and important, but it's also important for male politicians to be able to access provisions that enable them to spend time with their families as well. So it's not the provisions that are the problem, it's perhaps whether there's the guidelines are set at the right level that meets the expectations of the electorate.
Professor Andrea Carson from La Trobe Uni, Rachel Mealy with that report. Two more homes have been lost in the Tasmanian bushfires after a blaze erupted near the northeastern town of St Helens. Hundreds of locals and tourists were forced to flee, and many are now facing a second night away from home. Strong winds are continuing to fan the fires. The crisis comes after 19 properties were destroyed last week further down the coast at Dolphin Sands. Alexandra Humphreys reports.
Water bombing helicopters have been working throughout the day near St Helens on Tasmania's east coast. The state's fire service is hopeful the blaze can be contained, but says conditions are volatile. David Castella is the fire incident controller.
We've lost two confirmed houses in that fire. The crews faced really challenging conditions last night. Wind was very strong and erratic, and crews on the ground have done a fantastic job to limit that damage to two houses. It could have been a lot worse.
The danger escalated rapidly around St Helens yesterday afternoon, winds whipping up a nearby bushfire into an inferno. The blaze has now burnt through more than 1,400 hectares and knocked out power to hundreds of homes.
Wind is a big factor for us. If we do get a wind change that is going to impact through from a northeasterly wind that potentially could push the fire over the Tasman Highway into some unburnt areas, that is something that we're focusing on at the moment. That is a major concern for us.
Resident Anne Rath fled her home as the fire approached yesterday.
We could see the fire and it kept changing all afternoon and it didn't look at all serious. And then gradually it just got worse and the police came to the door and said we should evacuate. We just said, well, the property's not important, but our lives are.
St Helens is a popular tourist spot known for great fishing. It's also one of the largest towns on Tasmania's east coast. Local Jim Whelan took his boat out into the bay, preparing to help people trapped in an area on the other side of the bushfire.
I went up to Stiglitz and the fire just cranked up then. Yeah, lucky the choppers come in and they saved them houses there because it was pretty hectic there.
Stiglitz is 3 kilometres across a bay from St Helens. Resident Paul Wurstling decided to stay, as did many of his neighbours.
The simple plan was if anything changed or there's any danger coming, just get in the car and start honking your horn, just to let everyone know that, hey, it's time to get serious and just find out what's going on. The community aspect of this has just been unbelievable, and I got a shout out to every single person who volunteered to fight these fires. We had them on the street here at 2 o'clock this morning.
Paul Wurstling says those efforts have paid off.
So I could actually see the flames. They were licking the back fences of all the homes along the streets. And I'm pretty sure the fires have saved all them, which is just an incredible effort.
Mick Tucker is the local mayor. He says people poured into the council's evacuation centre.
Oh, look, it was in the hundreds. I know there's over 800 people have no power out there. So we had people that stayed on the boat ramp at Stiglitz last night as the last port of call. We had literally hundreds come through our evacuation centre.
According to Tasmania Police Inspector Luke Manhood, it's unclear when people who've been evacuated will be able to return home.
The problem that we've got is as the fire came through, it's damaged power poles, we've got power lines down, we've got trees that have fallen, and we've got some large trees in the area that are at risk of falling. So I suppose it's a stage effort of containing the fire and then getting that assessed and then making it safe.
It's the second fire on Tasmania's east coast to destroy homes in a week, after a blaze in Dolphin Sands destroyed 19 houses. Recent fires in New South Wales have also destroyed at least 20 houses, and a Parks and Wildlife firefighter was killed on the state's central coast.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. To South Australia now, where more than 2,000 prisoners have spent a third day locked in their cells after corrections staff walked off the job on Monday to protest against their pay and conditions. They're seeking a 20% pay rise over 18 months, a claim that has been rejected by the state government. The corrections staff have today voted to continue their strike indefinitely. Prisoner advocates are warning that inmates are being denied their human rights. Rachel Hayter prepared this report.
Prison officers in South Australia walked off the job on Monday morning. 3 days later, they're still on strike.
This is unprecedented in this state. We have never seen a walkout of this kind.
The union representing those workers is the Public Service Association of South Australia. Its General Secretary is Charlotte Watson.
What we are seeing today is the justice system collapse. These people are going in and dealing with crooks and crims day in and day out, and they're not getting anything for it. They're not getting less than the average parliamentary travel allowance for the work that they do.
Corrections workers argue that violence in South Australian prisons is getting worse. There are not enough staff and they're not paid properly.
I spent 13 years inside the walls at Yatala.
Dale Atkinson works with the Dog Squad in the Corrections Department.
These guys are at a heightened risk, more so now than what we ever have been. Obviously, like I said, with the benchmarking, and we've had a mass reduction in staff and whatnot, we don't have the numbers to adequately supervise, to search. Searching's probably the biggest thing. Because we don't have the staff there to search, all of the weapons and everything are getting secreted in little hidey holes and it's not getting picked up because we can't search, which puts everyone at a heightened risk.
Union members voted today to continue their strike indefinitely. Also joining the industrial action now are the state's intensive compliance officers, who monitor the ankle bracelets of 1,500 people in home detention. The union wants a 20% pay rise over 18 months, but the South Australian Deputy Premier, Kaya Ma, calls that unrealistic.
I can definitively rule out a paying 20% over 18 months, which is the equivalent to more than 13% a year. That is not something that is sustainable for the South Australian budget.
The union says the government's current offer of between 10.5 and 12.5% over 18 months is not enough. The state's treasurer, Tom Koutsantonis, describes the strike as irresponsible.
I'd say to the PSA, this is not good industrial action. This industrial action, if we didn't have the reserves in place, could put South Australians at risk, and they risk losing public support for their action.
CEO of the Corrections Department, David Brown, acknowledges the strike is limiting services to prisoners, like education programs.
We've got a lot of experience at running our institutions under emergency footings. We've got all of the experience that we gained during the COVID-19 pandemic. There are a range of activities that have been put on hold as we focus on delivering essential services things like education programs, training for staff.
Organising member for the National Network of Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls, Tabitha Lean, says prisoners' human rights are being denied.
The messages that have come out are extremely concerning, people not being able to phone their children. So we've got families on the outside extremely distressed by the fact that their children aren't able to speak to their parents and that visits aren't going ahead. The other thing that people are reporting is that they're not having access to their medical appointments, not having access to hospital transfers. We're also hearing from people who are stuck in police watch houses, not able to be transferred to prison, so they're stuck in watch houses, and people also aren't having their court transfers and aren't able to apply for bail or appear at their court matters.
Tabitha Lean has accused the union of leveraging the suffering of prisoners for financial gain.
This is not the way to go about it. It's a dangerous wage battle when prisoners are pulled into it in this way, and this is not a strategy. We would call this hostage taking.
Prisoner advocate Tabitha Lean, that report from Rachel Hayter. Residents of Phillip Island, southeast of Melbourne, are urging the Victorian government to make sure that the popular holiday spot continues to host the Australian Motorcycle Grand Prix. It's been an annual event there since 1997, but a 10-year contract with the organisers is due to expire next year. And the local council and businesses are worried the island's economy will take a huge hit if the race is held elsewhere. Elizabeth Cramsey filed this report.
Got him, I think.
Yes,
yes, he's got
it's
him.
An annual pilgrimage for motorsport fans.
Oh, who's this? Oh, it's Casey Stoner. No.
To one of the most iconic tracks in the country.
Stands at Phillip Island.
And on Phillip Island, one of the busiest people during MotoGP week is Rosa Scolato.
I like a pizza because it's easy to eat.
Miss Scolato runs a restaurant, Pino Trattoria, with her three kids, and she says it takes months to prepare for the huge influx of tourists.
We employ at least 35 to 40 people per day for the week.
In 2016, a contract was signed to keep the MotoGP in Phillip Island for 10 years. But that's set to expire in 10 months, and business operators like Rosa are worried they might not secure another.
It will be a big loss for the island, for all the island. There's accommodation, there is everything. I mean, really, it's like a big loss. We do the income for a couple, at least a month, because it's very continuous all day long.
For MotoGP fans in Australia, it's a big ticket item on the calendar. Ian Payne is the president of the Melbourne Sports Bike Riders Club.
It's the track that really is the draw card. You know, I mean, Eastern Creek is not a bad racetrack, but you can't see a lot of it like you can at Phillip Island. So for a spectator, you know, you can position yourself around the track and you can virtually see most of what's going on. And that's the beauty of it, I think.
And as for the thought of Phillip Island losing the race,
it would certainly be pretty devastating.
But if organisers did decide to move the MotoGP away from Phillip Island, where would they take it? Rochelle Halstead is the Bass Coast Shire Mayor.
Well, there's possibilities of it going anywhere. It could go interstate or international, but it is absolutely critical for our region to hold on to this race.
So she's urging the government to start the conversation and dive on in to the negotiations.
We really need them to move on this. It's such a critical part of our economy. Last race drew 91,000 attendees. And, you know, this race has a long history on the island. Racing began in the 1920s, and the first international Grand Prix was held in 1989. And our local businesses, really, they get probably a huge majority of their annual income from this one event alone.
But the impact wouldn't just be felt locally. Professor Tim Harcourt is the chief economist at the University of Technology, Sydney. He says the injection of cash from the race is enormous.
The last couple of years, it's been worth about $54 million, and it's, you know, almost 300 jobs. People who think you can measure these things exactly, I think, are quite wrong. You know, we've seen that with the value of the Tasmanian team being in the AFL. You can measure some things, but there's a lot of almost psychological benefits to a region or a country or a city that's very hard to measure, and you're not going to really know unless you don't have it. That's sort of a pretty big risk if you found out it was pretty good.
So business owners like Rosa Scalato are taking up the fight and urging the government to roll up their sleeves too.
So in this case, I think the government still need to help. Like, he helps a lot of football, like a sport. Why can he help the MotoGP? I mean, they advertise in Melbourne when it's Phillip Island. So if you want to advertise in Melbourne, you need to spend the money.
That's Phillip Island restaurant owner Rosa Scalato. Elizabeth Cramsey reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. PM will be back at the same time tomorrow. I hope you'll join me then. Good night.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. Minister Annika Wells is under intense pressure to justify her use of government entitlements, even if it's all within the rules. Today, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, on whether politicians deserve the benefits and why it's both a honeypot and a trap. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.